speaker is Paul Arvidsson about extinguishing the three-stone fire. So this is looking at the appropriate technology aspect of the title to this session.
Okay.
If you could, is yours on here?
I think it's on here.
Is it? Okay.
Is this it? No, that's not it. Did you put it on here?
No, I do. I don't have it.
Okay. Can I switch over to this?
If you think it will work. We had some technology problems, and we tried to work it off a notebook computer.
Can I switch it over to this machine?
Okay.
Which one does it say?
So we're going to try to switch to Paul's machine.
Yeah, the HDMI here.
About
VGA.
The extinguishing the three stone fire.
Which one says VGA?
And
to center projector. Is that it?
Paul has the honor to be one of the last four speakers of this conference. I appreciate all of you who came out to hear this last engineering session. Your paper is now up, so
okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. And this is called Extinguishing the Three-Stone Fire. And it is nice sometimes to be at the end of the conference because I get to respond or adapt my talk to what I've heard before. I'm particularly excited about Bill Jordan's talk that he just gave because this relates to some of the things I've been thinking about also. I have a couple of scripture verses here that motivated my thinking. First of all, looking at the need, I'm starting from different assumptions than you may have heard from in Hutchinson's paper or from Terry Gray's paper. I'm starting from the need base, from the demand side, not the supply side, and I'm starting from the focus on action rather than just talking. So I decided in my own personal work I should start doing something. Then I looked at my own background and skill set and decide, based on what I have as capabilities, experiences, what can I do? So that's the kind of the starting point that I took on this. I also, by the way, thought about the three Francises that Bill just mentioned. I started writing a talk about that. I'm glad I didn't give that talk here. I'm starting from this position. You know, you've probably heard of The White Man's Burden, the poem by Kipling or 1899. We talked about this idea of the mandate for the imperialism of England and so forth. But we're starting from a different point. We're starting from the poor woman's burden. And this is the situation in the world for billions of people. The vast majority of cooks in the world, of course, are women. In many places, such as in some places in West Africa, when a woman gets married, she has to go out in the woods and find three big rocks, bring them back, and set them up as a hearth, and she's married to that hearth for the rest of her life. So this is the picture shows the situation. Here's Chantel in little village in Burkina Faso, and she sets up these stones and a cooking pot and stirs the pot and cooks ugali or fufu or whatever she cooks. And that, of course, is very labor intensive, so it takes up a lot of the day. The labor involves also gathering the fuel. So here's an example, gathering firewood, going out and foraging in the woods to gather firewood. This leaves no days off for any other kind of opportunities, a life of pretty hard labor. It also leads, of course, to deforestation and lots of environmental issues, such as soil erosion, habitat loss for all the other creatures. A lot of the forests, such as in Haiti, where they've stripped 98% of the forest for charcoal, for burning. And this is, of course, a tradition brought over from Africa. It's also seen in places like Madagascar, where large swaths of the landscape have been taken for creating fuel for cooking. And so, of course, when you're cooking, whether it's indoors or outside, you have a lot of smoke, and probably more smoke, equivalent to hundreds of cigarettes a day. This is exposure mostly for women and children, and so this leads to respiratory diseases. The latest WHO estimate is something like 3.8 million people per year are killed by respiratory diseases from cooking smoke. Of course, nowadays we have an increasing number of refugees, something like 65 million people that are in and out of refugee camps. They are usually managed by UNHCR, the High Commissioner for Refugees, and in many of these camps, they don't have enough resources to provide fuel for all these people, so they have to forage outside the camp for wood or whatever. So this means there's about 3 billion people these days who depend on cooking over an open fire or a three-stone fire. So all these problems that I've outlined. So you would think we would start doing some research on this, right? We're scientists. We're trying to think about how to use our skills to do some research and development. Well, there have been some things done. There was a stove project at Lawrence Berkeley Lab that developed a low-cost cook stove that was fuel efficient, that would cook a meal on a small handful of wood instead of big logs. There are some cook stove testing centers run by EPA. There's Aprovecho up in Oregon that's been working on improved cook stoves. In 2010, a Global Alliance for Clean Cook Stoves was launched, and they have gathered together funds from many companies to do research on improved cook stoves. And that led to an EPA-funded program for $8.5 million that spread research funds across 9 different universities, including Fort Collins, the University of Colorado, Fort Collins, that developed the EnviroFit cook stove. And actually, that was reduced emissions by about 90%. That is exhibited in the Smithsonian now, actually. It's one of the research products that was developed. But that's not a whole lot of money compared to a lot of other R&D programs, as you can see. So my assessment is that there's not much being done in R&D in dealing with the energy problem for these 3 billion people around the world. So here we have the leaders of the Global Alliance for Clean Cook Stoves. We met in Ghana in 2015. I was at that meeting, and this is some of the individuals that were involved with that. Sorry about the flashing slides here. So the program involved about 30 countries. We had delegates who were developing an international standard for cook stoves, for the power, emissions, durability, safety, and user acceptance of cook stoves of all types. And that included another product that I'm particularly interested in, which is solar cooking, solar cook stoves. Back in 1976, Lester Brown, one of the early environmental heroes, made a little quote in Science magazine: "We need a basic overhaul, restructuring, and reorientation of the research establishment. We need to look around, and that means globally, not just in the US, at what are the pressing needs. One of them is a solar cooking device to offset the world firewood crisis. We can't divorce anything from the needs of the rest of the world." So that's kind of the direction that I'm looking here. So what is a solar cooker? Well, there's many concepts, many types, but the basic idea is they cook with solar thermal energy, not PV, no high tech, just a simple thermal device. So I'm particularly working on developing these panel cookers, because they are very simple, low cost devices. I joined a small nonprofit that was already operating in the DC area called Solar Household Energy. And their mission is to unleash the potential of solar cooking to improve the living and environmental conditions around the world. And so we do research, measurements and technology research. We do education, advocacy, and some field projects. So I'll tell you a little bit about what we've been doing. Here's our strategy. What I want to do in terms of the research is to build a community of collaborating scientists and engineers engaged in solar cooker research. It requires a lot of different specialties, different disciplines, and I'm hereby inviting you all to join us. We want to raise the bar on the quality of design. A lot of the work on solar cookers has been done by individual enthusiasts, kind of like a hobby. They get tinkering in their workshop and they come up with some design, but we're trying to raise the bar and also incorporate this work into the ongoing development of an ISO standard for cook stoves. The earliest widely distributed solar cooker was called the Cook-It, which is developed by Solar Cookers International based in Sacramento. They are low-cost cardboard-based thing, and about over 100,000 of these were distributed in Darfur and some of the refugee camps. But they're not very durable, made out of cardboard, so they don't last very long. On the other hand, Solar Household Energy developed something called the Hot Pot, which is much more durable, but it's also more expensive. So we distributed some of these hot pots at a refugee camp in Chad in 2011. So here's some of the women picking up their solar cookers. As you can see, there's not much forest left for them to use as a fuel. We also recently distributed a small number of parabolic solar cookers in Haiti in 2016. So there you have this group. So parabolic solar cookers are quite powerful, and they can cook a meal just as fast as a regular stove. So a whole series of families can use one parabolic cooker on a sunny day. The panel cookers are low-cost devices, so they cook slowly. They cook like a crock pot. How many of you have something like a slow cooker, a crock pot in your kitchen? And I met up with a man in San Diego, Roger Haynes. He's a retired attorney who decided on his own to start developing a low-cost solar cooker that would be more durable, but also cheaper than some of these other products. So I brought along the Haynes solar cooker. Here's what it looks like. It's a metallized polyethylene film with a thin coating of aluminum, and it has a polycarbonate windshield that keeps the hot air around the pot, and you put a pot in the middle here. I don't have a pot with me, so that's the basic idea. So that's what this looks like. So that's that's enough. That will cook 2.5 liters of, or that'll boil 2.5 liters of water in about 90 minutes on a sunny day, okay? You can't do it on a cloudy day, so for cloudy days or at night, you have to use a regular cook stove, right? So you have these two products. We also like the idea of heat-retaining devices like a basket, a thick basket filled with hay or straw or something to insulate it so that you can keep hot food until dinner time. And those are widely used also. My latest work that we are ongoing, in fact, in a couple of weeks, I'm going to be meeting with him in San Diego. We are working on using a reflector that is based on palm leaf mats instead of plastic, so that we can weave, you know, women all over the world know how to weave these simple materials that are available locally at zero cost. When you're talking about incomes of $1.25 a day, something like that, basically everything has to be free or you can't afford it. And so we're trying to drive down costs. That's our main engineering constraint. So we distributed some of these Haynes solar cookers in Chad last year. And when we did that, Patrick Fourier, our delegate, went and visited some of the women who were originally received the hot pots back in 2011. They're still using them. They're still not broken. They're still working. They use them routinely. So we are seeing user acceptance of these products in that situation. So there's kind of a summary of the information. We also recently did a demo project in Kenya. In northern Kenya, in the Kakuma refugee camp, we set up a grid of 500 spaces and had children cook their lunch with their solar cookers. So that was just to show how this can be done. We're also working on research projects to develop performance testing systems, and here's just some ideas of the measurements of heating curves of various devices. Partnering with Alan Bigelow at Solar Cookers International who developed a low-cost portable temperature measurement system based on an Arduino microprocessor. And this lower, this is another device that we put together. So the idea is that we believe that solar cooking has impact, potential to impact lots of other things. Disaster relief, but also routine use in a household where you have reduced emissions, reduced deforestation, that leads to better child safety, better maternal health, better women's safety. You don't have to go foraging out in the forest with all the risks of attacks that might give. It leads to possibilities for job creation because now that frees up a lot of women's time so that they can do useful things like get an education, get a job, start working, and lots of ways in which this kind of a concept can be applied. So just an illustration, here's an example of Marguerite Zunagra in Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso. She's out in the street there by her telephone booth where she sells time for cell phone use, that's her business. While she's doing that, she's cross-stitching, making something, and also while that she's doing that, her food, her lunch is cooking in her solar cooker. So this is no labor device. You just set it out in the sun, keep an eye on it, keep the goats from getting into your food, and life is good. Okay. We're running out of energy here. So my challenge to all of you, and particularly women, is to think about not just your cooking in your kitchen in the U.S., but how people around the world cook their food. And by the way, that's the main demand for energy for most of these people, right? Cooking. There's in the tropical region, there's not much need for heating, and they don't have high-powered electronics and so forth. It's the cooking that's probably over 90% of the energy demand. So it's entirely different a demand structure from what we see in the U.S. We have seen evidence that cooking habits can be changed and sustained. So I'm just challenging you to consider what skills you may have to adapt to this kind of work. Here's some of the examples of the kind of skill sets we need in order to grow this kind of research and this kind of development. So maybe some of those will apply to you. Here's the partners that we have been involved with so far in this work. Particularly might highlight Rotary, because Rotary works without bureaucracy. They work club to club from one place, such as Kenya, to the United States or Uganda. And we've worked and partnered with some of those other clubs. So I'm hoping to get more connected with them. Solar Foundation also is very helpful for us. So anyway, that's my story. Thank you for your attention. Competing on the basis of efficiency, where now keep in mind the sun is free, right? It's like the manna from heaven. It's distributed freely to everybody every day. You can't store it, just like manna. You can't store that overnight, right? But you can use as much as you want for free. And so this is like a gathering, a net to gather the manna from heaven. And efficiency would be how big a reflector do you need to get so much power into the pot? And so you could compete on the basis of efficiency. Awesome. That would be one way to do it.
So there's nothing going on now? I mean...
No, nothing going on now. Nope, nothing.
We'll talk. That's perfect.
Good.
Yeah.
Thank you. Back to the back.
My biggest concern is that you need to address it a little bit, but the whole cultural aspect of particularly uneducated
Yes.
Why should I change?
That's right.
And there's a lot of rain, I'm saying, so it's not always, you always have people really available.
Yes, that's certainly right. There are two main challenges in this work. One is to increase the awareness and acceptance of solar cooking among developed people, the developed world. The other is to build up awareness and acceptance of solar cooking among the less developed world. Okay? And they're totally different problems, really. But user acceptance is a big challenge, and that's why I was emphasizing that we have seen evidence of this, at least in some situations. Now, Chad, of course, is very sunny areas like the Sahara Desert. Thailand, it's a lot more cloudy. You couldn't use it maybe as often, but there are ways to do stove stacking. A lot of women already do what we call stove stacking. They have two or three or four different kinds of cookers for different applications, right? So this just becomes another part of the mix. And the advantage would be that it reduces your total fuel demand. You don't have to go gather wood as much, things like that. So there's ways that I think we can promote this and sell this, and we've looked at various kinds of business models. So that's an ongoing discussion. Thank you. Yeah, Jack.
You opened with a general story that theoreticians who are looking at the problem from the standpoint of global energy use. In your talk, you said, I'm going to go ahead and do something rather than just theorize. And I took personal umbrage. And so I'm wondering, your project is very admirable from a biblical and a health standpoint, but how big an impact will it have on global climate change?
Climate change? Well, you might note I didn't say anything about climate change in my talk. All right?
So I guess my question is, have you linked this to the big picture that the theoreticians are messing with in the area of energy?
Well, if you're thinking about climate change, I don't think that cooking practices have a lot of impact on climate change because it's a very small fraction compared to the ongoing slash and burn agriculture that's already standard practice in these countries. So if you look at satellite pictures from the NASA MODIS or Terra satellites, you see large swaths of Africa and India are lit up by fires due to normal agricultural practices. This, in terms of carbon, this is a small fraction. So I'm not too concerned about that. In terms of the global stuff, I will leave that to you. Big thing in terms of what?
Carbon emitter. I swear I heard that this week, but maybe I'm wrong. Anybody? No.
Fractionally, it's not a large fraction of the total CO2 production. But of course, it is the production that is produced by these people, because as Paul said, that's the energy they do. But by the way, Jack, I don't take umbrage at all. I applaud Paul.
It was easy, Paul. It was the health impact.
Yes, that's the main driver, is the health impacts. And also, but I'm thinking also in terms of the long term, I'm thinking about women. The point of view, let me give you another illustration. I was at a conference, a AAAS conference on food security. And all the people in the audience, they were food experts on food security from the UN and everything. And they were saying, we need to make sure that we have enough tons of grain, enough tons of wheat, and all supplied for these refugees and all these people around the world. And to a man, they all said, they were thinking of food as bags of grain in a warehouse. And I was pointing out, wait a minute, to me, food is a plate on my table that I eat, a meal. What's the gap in between? Oh, that's the women's work. That doesn't matter. That's just cooking, right? And so that's what I'm concerned about. There's a gap in our consciousness about what's involved in cooking. It involves labor, lots of labor, right? Water, energy, materials, you know, infrastructure, whatever. So those gaps are big, and that's where I would like to put more of the focus. Yes?
I wonder, after these systems have been deployed, have you ever observed locals innovating with how they use them or trying to make them more efficient on their own?
I think that would certainly happen. There just are very limited field experiences with this. Limited field projects. We just don't have the resources to do bigger projects. And so we're starting small. Yeah. Yes?
Kind of following up on the question from the bathroom, what cultural barriers have you seen in use of these stories?
Lots of different cultural barriers, things that you would not imagine. For example, let me give you another story. There was a group down in Bolivia that has been with the Whitfields, a couple. They've been developing these box cookers, and they make these things, and then they bring them out and just demonstrate them and show the people how they work, and they've been doing that for many, many years, decades. And Ruth Whitfield put one of these box cookers on her back and hiked way up into the mountains into a little village in Bolivia, and she set this box cooker up in the middle of the village and started cooking a meal. And, you know, it was boiling away, bubbling some beans or whatever. And some of the people in the village started looking around, and they saw this. And some of the leaders came out from the village, and they looked above it, and they looked below it, and they didn't see any fire. Here it was all boiling away, cooking. And so they figured she was doing magic. She was a witch. So they took the box and drove her out of the village. So yes, there are cultural issues.
I want to thank our speakers, Paul, and the others for today.